So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And today, we're going to talk about a couple things. Mainly, we've all survived the Twitter apocalypse. We're okay. Don't worry about us, everybody. And also, Sherlyn's going to be diving into Windows on ARM, which
Lordy
is...
Lordy.
Oh boy, her favorite thing, which is...
No!
You know, this is the newer version of Windows... or revamped version of Windows that's meant to work with low-powered ARM chips. And Sherlyn just reviewed one of those machines. She loves it so much. Clearly one of the highest scores I've ever seen Sherlyn give anything. Yeah. So we're going to dive into that, kind of what this means for the future of Windows, and also how this may give us a sense of what's going on with Apple Silicon and their upcoming MacBooks powered by their own chips. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review. That's all really, really helpful. Wednesday night, right after we got done planning this podcast, some major news happened. We started seeing crazy Twitter posts from Elon Musk, Kanye, Bill Gates, for this kind of crazy Bitcoin scheme where he was asking people to send them Bitcoin and they will double your money back. It turns out this was a pretty widespread hack and one of the biggest hacks we've ever seen on Twitter. It's a strange thing because like they got access to all these high profile accounts. The only thing they did is this crummy Bitcoin scheme. It seems like you could do a lot more. So continuing with the 2020 theme of the dumb reality... This is truly the dumb reality of this hack. It turns out this was, Twitter says this was a social engineering attack. A hacker was basically able to get into these accounts through one of Twitter's engineers and also an internal tool that they use to administer accounts, which may be more powerful than it should be. So that's kind of all that. Sherlyn, where were you during the great Twitter apocalypse?
So it happened around like 6 p.m. Eastern, and I was technically off work, but
Sherlyn is still never off work.
I was still addressing some final edits on a piece, so I was in our Slack, right? And as the news was breaking, as can sometimes, you know, happen, our Slack gets very buzzy, like oh crap, what's happening? So like we saw like one person first was Elon Musk, and then it was like,
well, and when it was Elon Musk, we were like, oh, this is a real thing, right? He is just doing this weird Bitcoin scheme because he craves attention. We understood it from Elon Musk, but once other people started popping up,
I know, I remember very clear, when it was just different. Like, so yeah, so part of our process is we like go through heads together as a team to decide if they're good. And one of the original headline for that story was Elon Musk and other high profile accounts. Then Bill Gates came out and we were like, oh God, throw Bill Gates in the headline.
It's everybody.
And then Apple happened, and then we had to throw Apple in the headline. So it was like ridiculous. It was a lot of fun just kind of watching, because since I was off work, I didn't have to worry about really contributing to the conversation.
Sure, sure. You were just sitting cackling at the fire kind of brewing. It's amazing because it took Twitter an hour. Carissa Bell, who has been on the show and is our social media reporter, she did a great job of kind of distilling all this down, so go check out her coverage. This is one of those things where it took Twitter an hour to, I think, even publicly respond. Maybe they were just running around trying to stop all this. It almost seems like this is one of those situations where, you know, Jack Dorsey probably has a big red, you know, shut down Twitter button. Probably would have been a good time to just hit that button. Twitter kept trucking an hour or so after all this started. Then I think they disabled tweeting by verified accounts. So blue check accounts. And then it was like, I don't know what you call it, the inmates running the asylum. Then Twitter turned into this thing where everybody was celebrating the fact that there were no blue checks. Let me tell you guys, I have a blue check. Sherlyn has a blue check. These are not special things. The only reason we have blue checks is because we work for a place that buys Twitter ads, and it's all a goddamn scheme. Like everything else in this world It's just a scheme because that we pay Twitter. That's all.
I didn't think that that was part of the reason that we got the blue checks.
No, most media personalities have blue checks is because of that, unless you're a celebrity.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, the justification I made for myself was that I actually have had my identity, like, stolen several times. And, like, people have pretended to be me on Twitter.
Well,
so
it is useful for people who do journalism stuff, too, because if we spread misinformation, it could be a lot more damaging than, a normal person, I guess.
Right, a person who's not expected to be reputable or credible. Yeah.
So anyway.
It was very funny. I missed the entire, like, silencing of the blues. So I didn't even know. But when I came back to Twitter, it was already okay to... Well, I did try to tweet when it was, like,
you couldn't
happening.
Tweet, but you could retweet other people. And blue checks could also retweet their own posts. So it was sort of like just, like, people pinging from, like, purgatory, like, saying, hey, I'm alive. I'm alive. I'm communicating through... these random old, these random old things. It's sort of like, I'm thinking, I don't know, like a cartoon robot that can only speak in, isn't that a Transformer? It felt like we were all Bumblebee from Transformers. We could only communicate in bits and clips of culture and things we've said before. It was kind of surreal. Like, is this the future? Is this the future of our communication? I don't know.
No, anyway, it's not the future. No.
Everything is fine now. Twitter is fine. I'm sure there's going to be a bit of a reckoning here because that is a severe security gap. If one not so smart hacker was able to get in here and take over all these accounts. So this is an ongoing story. Stay tuned from us and follow Carissa Bell on Twitter for more details on this. So, Sherlyn, let's move on to your favorite thing. I know you really love talking about this because you love reviewing these stupid laptops.
Wow.
We're talking about Windows on ARM. And this is a special version of Windows that's been recompiled to work on ARM processors. And that's a whole thing. What do we mean by Windows on ARM? What do we mean by ARM, Sherlyn?
So, ARM is a company... they design microprocessors, and microprocessors are these little things that go in on your processors that run your computers, right? They're like everything, like a molecule has an atom, that sort of thing.
And to be clear, ARM is a chip design company. They design these things, and other companies end up building on their design. So Qualcomm, with their Snapdragon chips, they are building on things ARM initially designs. It's kind of how all this works out.
Right. What Qualcomm would do and say, like what Qualcomm, for example, would do is they would license designs like Cortex A7 for building like microprocessor cores, or they could just, or like someone like Apple who wants to build his own custom chipset could get an instruction sheet or a set of instructions from ARM and use that to build their own designs. Mm-hmm.
And so, that's been true of Apple's mobile chips for a while now. They all implement ARM designs. So ARM... chips known for mobile devices, highly power efficient compared to Intel's chips, right? And AMD's chips, x86 chips, those are things made for PCs. They're meant to be more high powered. They can handle a lot more work, but they're not so great in phones, as Intel learned 10 years ago or so. Like Intel just could not make phones work. So, why are we talking about Windows on ARM? Like, what's the whole deal
with
this?
So, we're talking about Windows on ARM, I think, in part because it's timely, because my review of the Lenovo Flex 5G just went up. You know, Microsoft has been trying to make Windows on ARM work forever. But, like, let's take a step back. What is Windows on ARM? Now, on the ARM developer page, this is the reasoning, right? Windows on ARM basically is a... way for developers to kind of get smartphone processor architecture into the laptop market. And so they're saying that since there are around 700 million active devices using Windows 10, this is like significant for developers to build apps for. And, you know, it will, you know, using ARM-based chips in laptops will enable smartphone-like experiences like all-day battery life, instant on, always connected through LTE or even 5G in the case of the Lenovo Flex 5G. So there's a lot, lordy lord. I mean, like, oh my God.
Let me just say. So I feel like this whole thing came about because a lot of, first of all, mobile chips, ARM chips are getting faster and pretty capable.
Yes.
The hardware inside of, if you have a leading Android phone right now or even an iPhone, they're very, very fast compared to what PCs could do 10, maybe even 5 years ago. So I think the thinking is, hey, these really efficient mobile chips, you put them in a laptop, give them a little more work to do and a bigger screen, and all of a sudden you can have a machine that's super, super thin, super light, and can still last a day or so with battery life.
Yeah.
And it's this weird... It is a thing that they're exploring, that PC companies are exploring, because just we can. The hardware is getting more capable. This kind of goes back to Microsoft's first Surface, the Surface RT, which was a disaster.
That's when the whole drama started.
That's when it all started. But that was a disastrous device, because that thing was the first Windows device to run Windows RT, which is sort of the precursor to Windows on ARM. That was Windows developed for mobile chips. It was awful. It couldn't do any, it could run a handful of apps, but it couldn't really do anything. It could barely install anything from the Windows Store. So my favorite, one of my favorite reviews of that I've ever written was of the first Surface RT. And I think one of my first lines was, I wanted to throw this thing out the window.
Yeah.
It was just such a god-awful experience. I think over time, Microsoft has learned, you know, the Surface devices have moved on from Windows RT. They've kind of killed that whole thing. Intel's designs, Intel's chips have gotten more efficient, so they've been able to fit into thinner tablet-like devices like that. But there is still a need. Still somebody like saying, man, if I could create a one-pound laptop, what could that look like? You know, a laptop that's the weight of an iPad but has all the functionality that you'd expect from a computer. That is why Windows on ARM is still a thing. You reviewed, what was it, the Flex 5G, but you also reviewed, Sherlyn, the Surface Pro X, which also had a wonderfully low score. What is the what is the problem with Windows on ARM, right? This is the idea, more efficient Windows, lighter machines, longer battery life. What is the problem that we keep seeing?
Our main issue is app compatibility being very confusing because it's incomplete, but also because of the way Windows 10 on ARM works right now. So right now, and I went down this developer hole. I go down holes a lot, apparently, right? Last week it was
Don't go down developer holes, like and you'll just end up in 4chan. It's not good.
It was a very deep learning session for me. And considering this was after 2 weeks of hard, like, it was a very hard turn from, like, studying FDA regulations and FCC telehealth regulations for 2 weeks. And I pivoted hard into, like, Windows 10 on ARM architecture. Anyhow, Windows 10 on ARM right now uses ARM 64 architecture on these machines that I've been reviewing recently. So there's a difference in terms of ARM architecture and x86, which we sort of just went over, which is the Intel machines. But within those two, there's also 32-bit support versus 64-bit support, which basically just means your apps are more performant on the higher bit number ones. They're just, like, faster and better, like,
faster, better. I mean, they support more memory. That was the whole idea.
Right.
With 64-bit apps, which Apple has made standard as of a couple years ago, Microsoft is pushing, you can support more memory with 64-bit systems, so we needed to make that shift away,
Right, but the thing is 32-bit still exists in certain, in certain, you know, for certain software that you might still want to use from ages ago. Anyway, so with ARM, Windows on ARM, with ARM 64, what Microsoft has done is to, it supports 32 and 64-bit natively through ARM 64, sure. But it, for the x86 architecture apps, it actually only supports 32-bit through an emulation layer.
Wait, what?
So there is a,
Can you slow down and just, so what apps can I use on a Windows on ARM machine?
You can use an app that has been specifically compiled for ARM 64, which means it uses that architecture and is submitted with that package. Or you can use.
And where do you find these apps? Are you saying only on the Windows Store? Can you find? Can you download these apps too?
So most of these natively supported apps are UWP, Universal Windows Platform apps. These are the ones that you
throw
download
more acronyms at people.
I know.
Come on,
I know.
Microsoft. Okay.
But yeah, so they're all the ones that you get through the App Store, right? Yeah. So they're basically mobile apps. And then you have, technically, again, Microsoft is saying that it has support for this Win32 x86 apps. But again, like I said, it runs through an emulator, which means, like, the whole thing was like, developers don't have to do a thing.
Right, right. It just works. It just works,
guys. It just works.
Except it's only working for older PC apps.
But for all these Win32 apps, really what's happening is that the ARM, that Microsoft has designed an emulation layer that communicates with the kernel and drivers and stuff like that. And it's doing all that parts. It's basically like a translator, right? So it's basically like if you're cooking from, let's say, a recipe in a language you don't understand, and then you're trying to get a translator in the middle to explain to you the steps rather than, say, learn the language yourself or have the recipe translated to your language from scratch. And that's what they're struggling because
these apps will run, but not as fast as a natively compiled app. And that's kind of sad too, because first of all, these chips are already slower than Intel chips and AMD chips and normal PC chips. Yeah. And then they're running older software, which is not optimized. So it's like a double whammy of, really slow app experience then. Yeah.
So basically app compatibility isn't there. Let's just put it this way. App compatibility isn't there. Now, what happened in my review, and this has happened in a lot of reviews, but the most recent one was that I tried to install Slack. Yeah. And again, they're pitching this as you don't have to make any changes. You don't have to do anything different, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I go onto Slack and I look at my system's software information and it's 64-bit on ARM, right? Yeah. Okay, cool. I am a tech reviewer and I know what that means. If I handed this laptop to like my neighbor or my mom or whoever, they're going to assume this was 64-bit whatever. So when they go to the Slack
download they wouldn't even know what 64-bit means. It should just work.
They wouldn't know. It should. Yeah. But anyway, if they head it over to the install page for most things, and
Where on the website or on the Microsoft Store?
On the website. Because the Microsoft Store is better at, like, first of all, the Microsoft Store apps are all like already natively supported. Yeah, so there's less of an issue there.
So were you installing Slack from the website, but it is on the Microsoft Store. So
it is. But part of my just general workflow wise, right? Like, who uses the Microsoft
Store? Okay, first of all, stop. Let's slow down. Who uses the Microsoft Store? People running Windows on ARM machines have to, because that's the only way you get compatible apps.
Okay. Do you have, so Slack?
And I use that thing all the time. Let me tell you, because I am every week or so, I'm resetting up Windows on a new PC, you know, to review. The Windows Store, even though it's not sexy or anything, it is a very fast way to be like, okay, I'm gonna get Evernote, I'm gonna get Slack, I'm gonna get Spotify all within a couple clicks. I don't have to go to websites, you know?
Yeah, I'm definitely like much more old school in the sense that like I generally download everything off of just straight the internet. I love going through the browser being my window. But I agree with you, like it might be easier to get all these UWP apps on
it will,
the
store. It will definitely be easier to do it through the
store. I'm sort of, I guess, hesitant to run UWP apps on is back when I'm using Intel machines, right? When I have a full desktop experience in front of me, why do I want a UWP app? Like, I'm not interested. I don't know. That's just my experience. Okay. And
let me just take a step back here, because this UWP slander will not stand. Like, even iTunes has a supported app on the store now. Windows users, make your lives easier. Use the Windows Store app, because also you get the automatic updates. You get like all the stuff, and it installs more easily. It is updated more easily. So
it's the
same thing. They're just packaged differently, and they're actually a little safer too, because they run in like a separate security layer. So it's the easiest way and safest way for Windows users to get their software. But okay, Sherlyn, you like to go to the web. That is what you're trying to do with these machines.
I'm just going to say, I guess I was feeling the burn from RT days, where like UI and all of that crap was just so bad that I just don't like Windows Store.
The Windows Store, let's get even more confusing. The Windows Store now supports normal WinUI apps. So that's the Windows apps that look like normal things and not like the weird Metro design we used to have. So the Windows Store now supports both. Yeah. They're not literally EXEs, but they look like, you know, iTunes looks like iTunes. They didn't redesign iTunes because it's on the Windows Store, you know? So now it supports normal things. It supports games, because the previous mandates made it hard for the Windows Store to even have a game and run games properly. So, okay. I see where we're at.
So I mean, the messaging, I guess, should be then that, like, when you're using a Windows on ARM situation, only download from the Microsoft Store. Then you run into different situation of compatibility where, like, not every app is on the Microsoft Store.
Not every, at least then I feel like when you're in the store, it'll be like, oh, this app will not run in this machine.
Right. And the messaging will be clear. Yeah. It'll be less confusing on there. But if you're, but then you still have the desktop experience, which is nice to have. Mm-hmm. But then, like, it's again like kind of free for all and like Wild West as to like what people try to download and install. Anyway, this is the situation I ran into. Slack website, not the store. 32-bit option, 64-bit option. So I received a reader email after the review was published, and it was like, you know, very like factual. It was laying out all the things for me. So this reader, Michael, said that, you know, I noticed that when you install the Slack app, you know, the file name said x84 64-bit. So it was even like compiled for the different architecture.
Right.
So kind of like what Michael laid out for me was that like, and also not like, it wasn't something I didn't know. It was more like I missed out this little thing, right? I forgot completely that like, oh yeah, what I did was download an x86 app that wasn't even supposed to run. But Michael also raises the point that this is an issue Apple Silicon is going to have to face and figure out as well.
Yes.
And Michael also pointed out that, you know, what it, the onus is kind of on developers to recompile, or Microsoft and these like our ecosystem designers to be like, can you please recompile your app?
So, Sherlyn, did you ever try installing Slack through the Windows Store to see if it would work?
Not yet, because like if, see, here's what happens. If the, I downloaded the 32-bit version and it did work through the emulator.
Yeah,
and honestly, it's been running fine. The emulator is fine. There's other bugs with the Windows 10 on ARM program that came up during the review. Like,
right,
I would double click.
Hit me. Like what?
Dev, imagine you go to like your folder full of screenshots to look at a benchmark result or something. And you double click it and nothing loads. Just nothing.
Okay.
Nothing. A window will pop up and it's white. It's just all plain white.
This
it's
reminds me
canvas.
Of like my 486 days. I remember having to wait for things. Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't just waiting. I waited like 17 minutes. It didn't load. It just straight up wasn't happening.
Uh-huh.
So there were little bugs like that. And like that's a bug that was captured on our video after I shipped the laptop over to our video producer, who was able to replicate the issue on his own too. So it's not just me. How? What the shit?
That shit. I cannot wait until we use that as a laptop review title. What the shit? What is
I also
up
just,
with this?
For me, it's like, for me, I think my anger is coming from a place of the people who are rushing to defend the system.
Yeah,
I understand there are merits, but y'all, this can't happen. Like, why are you defending a system that won't load pictures from File Explorer?
And here's where I talk about the difference between, like, theoretical benefits and, like, the things ARM and the things Qualcomm tends to talk about with these systems. It's like, yeah, when a Windows on ARM machine means, you know, yeah, it could have better battery life, it could be a lot thinner, but they're realistically using it, you will run into a lot of issues, and this app compatibility is one of them. Sherlyn, I think even if you were using the Windows Store properly, as you should, and I'm gonna show you the ways of the store,
yeah,
but even if you were doing that, you would run into a lot of these issues, and it's just not a great experience, you know. So you can think of Windows on ARM is a way of running stripped down Windows. And to me, this makes me think of everything Apple is doing right now too, because they just announced that they're going to be moving over to Apple Silicon, their own chips, which are based on ARM designs. And they're going to be doing this within 2 years.
Yep.
Microsoft has been working on Windows on ARM, you know, for I think over 5 years now, but Windows RT goes back to, you know, 2011, 2012. Windows RT goes back a while. There are so many issues for developers.
Yeah.
There are so many issues when it comes to power. These ARM chips have gotten a lot faster than before, but compared to even a mid-range Intel or AMD chip, I really don't know how they're going to stack up.
I'm
really wondering, how is Apple going to do this within 2 years and not piss everybody off and not, you know, make developers give up on Apple entirely?
Apple has a few advantages
compared
to Microsoft. It only, like, I, again, what part of the studying I did for this episode at midnight yesterday after finishing edits on my telehealth opus was I watched Rene Ritchie's video about Apple Silicon, which he recently just posted, like within the past 24 hours of us recording this. And he was explaining that, some of the advantages Apple has is that Apple when they are making chips, they're only making for themselves, right? They're not, so they don't have to worry about like making their design a bit more modular so that like, you know, someone who's an OEM wants to like build it into, they don't have to make it package it so neatly. They can really like think
they
about.
They make it for Apple. And that's that's kind of been the advantage of the iPhone mobile chips and the iPad chips too, is that they're not building for thousands of Android devices. They're building for the handful of things that they know that they, that they are actually creating.
Apple has also demonstrated that it can do this better than like if it were a full-on chip company. Like there are things chip companies will do better because they have the expertise, but let the Apple A11, A12, all the Bionic chips, they're all just pretty freaking good because Apple's only building for iPhones and it can do that. And there's just like that video was really great. I mean, like, again, I watched it last night, so I can't remember all of it now. It was a 14-minute long video explaining all of this. And there's just things that like Apple can custom create its own GPU for all of these purposes. You know, Apple like doesn't have to. I just think that like
they bought because several chip companies, by the way. So the, they can literally create their own GPU tech. They really they can have a hold on how all this works, which is something Microsoft cannot do. Microsoft can partner with AMD, which they did for the Surface Pro, the Surface Laptop 3, 15-inch. They had a custom AMD chip, and they work together with Intel and stuff. But yeah, they don't build their own chips, not in the same way.
Right, and Apple can do things like have the software speak, you know, more specifically to certain parts or whatever, and just to make efficient performance overall. So like, there is reason to have like excitement and hope about this. I'm not saying that it won't take work. Like Apple needs to figure out how to make it work because there are going to be huge benefits of shifting over to ARM because the energy efficiency for longer battery life is going to be huge in general.
MacBooks are actually pretty terrible at that compared to most PCs and ultrabooks. Like good luck getting, you know, beyond 10 hours of battery life on the MacBook Pro, even though I can regularly do that with an XPS 13 or something. Let me just say, I'm kind of wary now because I remember the last time Apple switched chips, and that was from their PowerPC designs. It was like 2005 to Intel. And to me, that was exciting because Intel was producing better hardware. It would make it easier for Apple to design new machines. And it also meant we could do cool things like run virtualized Windows within Macs. Like it really changed the whole ecosystem. For Apple, those benefits are not there for ARM. Like it's not opening up new doorways to things. It's actually adding more limitations for what Apple computers can be doing. So over the next few years. So first let me just say this real quick. Do not buy first generation Apple Silicon. And this is true for pretty much every first generation product that's really new. Yeah. Let Apple work out these kinks because there are going to be quite a few of them. So let me just say, I'm super worried. This is going to be a really rocky next few years for Apple. It'll be amazing if they really do this smoothly. But yeah, go ahead, Sherlyn. Where are you trying to go?
One of the things that Rene Ritchie pointed out in his video is that, you know, the original iPad was introduced with custom Apple chips as well. And, you know, after a while, we got to a point where on the iPads, the A, whatever it was at the time, like I think the third or fourth gen iPad, he was saying, was running better than a MacBook because, again, like just the whole thing was designed better, right? And the whole thing was designed within Apple so it could run apps better. But I still agree with you that like first gen is never really worth buying unless like you're super excited to test something out and you're aware of the consequences. But I do think app compatibility is going to be an issue for Apple as well. Just that like Apple, again, has more control over developers. They're also able to get developers to do things in a way that Microsoft generally doesn't seem to be able to.
And let me just say real quick too, like Apple Silicon makes a lot of sense for, you know, the MacBook Air and maybe even the MacBook Pro, but for really, really high-end work, for video editing, for the work that people really demand from these machines, I think the Mac Pro, I think the higher-end, like the 16-inch MacBook Pro, you'll have to keep Intel around. You have to keep these more performant processors around. So I also wonder how they're going to coexist. How is Apple Silicon going to coexist with, you know, the existing hardware? Because are they going to split Mac OS and have two different versions of it like Windows is doing? It's all very confusing. I think it's kind of exciting, but
I'm not sure because
after seeing all these Windows on ARM machines.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, right, with the power, even the, so the Lenovo Flex 5G that I just reviewed, mm-hmm. another thing that was very interesting about it was that it ran with the Snapdragon 8cx chipset, and the X in that name stands for extreme.
Sure.
So that's what Qualcomm said, and it's like for them it's like their highest power like Snapdragon made for PC chip, and it's meant to go ahead against Intel's Y series ultra portable thin and light, so still like kind of not even the highest end.
So Intel's dinkiest little processors, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, so like ARM probably has some limits in terms of performance, even though it does bring benefits like battery life. I kind of want to quickly point out though, Snapdragon mm-hmm. PCs are a subset of Windows on ARM. They bring things like they offer LTE connectivity at the very least, if not 5G. I do think like Dev was saying, don't buy first gen, because this Lenovo Flex 5G is a first gen 5G laptop. Uh-huh. So like one of the first 5G laptops. Do not buy a 5G laptop this year.
Don't buy a 5G laptop. If you really want that 5G action, maybe look at the hotspots, because I think those are really interesting. And then if you get a 5G hotspot, then yeah, you could put multiple devices on that. And, it's not integrated, but it's fine.
Yeah, the good thing about the Flex 5G is that, like, yeah, it's not only 5G, you get gigabit LTE too. Mm-hmm, so, yeah, if you're mm-hmm. looking for that and future-proofing that, sure. But, good Lord, it's, like, so heavy. It's chunky. It's $1,400 in a global recession. This is not the year to buy.
How heavy
is
the Flex 5G?
It was, like, I think 2.98 pounds was the...
Really?
Might be like,
so, nearly as much as, like, a 13-inch MacBook Pro.
You know what? I'm going to circle back to you. The actual number is on my review that's already published. So, go read it. Feel free to get angry at me or at the laptop. Either way, I wanted this to be good. Mm-hmm. And I was so hyped for Windows on ARM. I was so hyped for Snapdragon PCs. Because when I first heard about it, we were in Computex,
yeah,
Taiwan,
two or three years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was really, really, I was into it. And I think that, again, I feel like I'm defending myself because a lot of people are throwing hate at me.
So look up Sherlyn's work on like the always connected Windows PC stuff, because that's where Microsoft and Qualcomm were initially pitching this, right? The idea of super thin machines that could last over a day, having
and they're always
connectivity.
Connected.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
Sure, that sounds like the perfect laptop for me. But mm-hmm. for now, you're giving up quite a lot to live that dream, basically.
I'm going to revisit the whole like Windows Store thing. I just need that wording to be clearer. I need Microsoft to make that so much clearer to users. And again, $1,400, if it can't run every app that you'll ever need, is too much money.
This was a Surface problem, and it seems like they'll never be able to get away from it.
So I have been studying Windows 10 on ARM for a long time. Devendra has some experience with it too, but I want to know what people out there really think of it. Like, I want to know if you already have used it and you have some thoughts, or mm-hmm. if you just are watching from the sidelines and also have some thoughts. Send us all of those, ideas and thoughts to podcast@engadget.com.
And let us know if you're excited about Apple Silicon, because, oh boy, that is going to be dramatic. Yeah. Let's move on to some news quickly. Hey, guess what launched this week? Another streaming service. NBC Universal's Peacock. Peacock, first of all, the chutzpah to launch a service with that name right now, even though I guess the iconic Peacock of NBC really, really is selling this to people. What's really interesting, I think, is that Peacock has a free tier. You can launch, the Peacock app and watch some ads and still enjoy a lot of their shows that they're offering.
That's nice.
So that includes a lot of NBC content, some sports. They're going to be launching a 24-hour Today Show type deal, which to me sounds like a nightmare. But okay, we're going with this. It's kind of interesting in that respect. But man, there's a $5 plan that's like premium with fewer ads and a $10 plan that has no ads at all. They don't really have much original content, although I've heard a couple things about some of their shows. Like, I think there's one called The Capture that's supposed to be really good. It's coming in such a weird point. What do you think?
I don't think that 24-hour live stream thing is going to be sustainable.
It's not going to be a live stream. It's going to be content, like scheduled content of the Today Show and rerunning segments and things like that.
And would that be like... in the free tier, accessible by the free tier, or is that paid content?
I believe so. The paid content is mainly for things like sports. So like the Premier League, if the next season is actually happening, that's going to be on Peacock. You have to pay for that. That is carrying over stuff from NBC's previous paid sports services. It gets all really confusing. But they are offering some things. And I think sports fans in particular will appreciate some of this. But man, who needs another one of these right now? You're really just going with it. So
I also, the only reason I kind of like Peacock caught my eye this week was that it was trending on Twitter, hashtag join the flock. And to your point, Devendra, you mentioned this. It is so, so cheesy. I was like, is this really your hashtag, Peacock?
Well, here's the thing. Like, Peacock isn't really getting much fanfare. I don't think it's getting as hyped up as something like Quibi. It will last. Like, it will probably be the thing that will still be up and running after Quibi dies, because it has a free tier. You know, people could just sit there and watch it and not have to, like, actually pay anything. So I think that makes it a little more compelling. But yeah, I have so much energy. Like, I've been trying to keep up on everything on Apple TV and Disney Plus and HBO Max and everything right now. This final one, I don't know if I have the energy for it. So Peacock is here. I don't know. What sound does a peacock make? Nobody knows. In other news, we also got a bit of a climate plan from Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee. And it's just a little $2 trillion climate plan that is focusing on clean energy and transportation and things and jobs related to clean energy that could help rebuild the country. That's a lot of money. That's a pretty good plan. I think it's the most widespread climate plan certainly we've ever heard from a leading nominee and certainly a Democratic nominee. So
ish, yeah.
Go check out the reporting on this. I don't think we haven't covered it specifically, but the New York Times has a couple great pieces on it. I think this is all really interesting and exciting. And on a personal level, like, to me, we're facing a global recession right now, and also in America, we're facing widespread unemployment at unprecedented levels. Focusing on things like climate change and how you could create jobs around that, in the past, during the whole COVID epidemic, we've basically lost all the solar installation jobs that have been building up over the last few years. And to me, that's really sad, because that is the sort of thing where you could take somebody who has skills already for maybe industries that may be dying out and just reapply it to, like, hey, just put these things on roofs, learn some new skills to kind of help the country clean up our energy. I think there's a lot of potential there. People need jobs, and we need to do more work towards climate change. So this is all very exciting to me. I hope it actually goes somewhere. I'm worried, because we're still a country that is debating the value of masks, and I worry about a lot of things. Speaking about masks and speaking about myths, I want to throw a quick shout out to something Facebook is actually doing
stop talking about Facebook, will you?
They've launched a new section to fight coronavirus myths. And after, we rag on them quite a bit because they honestly can't do much right. This is good. This is a company with, over 3 billion users and putting good information out there and squashing conspiracies. Sure, that's good.
Where is this new section? At the top of the news feed or...?
I have not seen it specifically. It looks like it's another section that shows up, when you log into Facebook.
So, because one of the things that Facebook was trying to do was also have a box at the top of everyone's news feeds was to, like, have voter registration information for people of voting age in the U.S. And it's just like, okay, so now you have this section as well on top of it, like, Carissa, I think, said in our Slack one day, like, oh, the newsfeed's just going to be like myth debunking zone now, or like the newsfeed's going to be PSAs now, because that's what Facebook has been doing. I do think it's a good move on their part to, like, do that. It's, they need to stop misinformation on their platform. They need to do better. This is maybe a good start. I don't know. I don't think we've all ever seen this, though.
It's a start, and it's something we, at least, I can't just, like, say, hey, this is terrible. So it's something good for Facebook.
Yeah. Based on the screenshot that we saw via CNBC report, it does look like a little a panel or a card at the top of the news feed right after everyone's stories on your feed. You know, the sample that I see says, wear cloth face clothing to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Sure, like, okay, great, Facebook, but there's still going to be people who refuse to see that message.
Yeah,
so
the good messaging is one thing, but also actively fighting against misinformation is something the company still needs to do better with. So we shall see.
Speaking of coronavirus and a global health pandemic, oh boy, that telehealth thing that I've been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks, yeah, that's finally going live. I thought I submitted 5,500 words to our managing editor on this topic. Actually, I only submitted 2,400, but that is still a very long article for a non-review, for a non-flagship review for us, so take a read. It's been really nice to work on, like, so much reporting. I was able to, like, talk to a lot of doctors, telehealth operators, or people working in telehealth, and patients, and the AMA, and the FCC, and the FDA. Like, it was just so great to do so much reporting on this one topic and learn about all of the stuff that's going on. Basically, the main takeaway from my article is that, like, yes, telehealth can be good, but it could also exacerbate certain, like, disparities in the healthcare system if we don't have policies that, like, look at the accessibility of it all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the rich poor divide is only going to get worse if we just rely on telehealth way too much. And, you know, people without access to things like good broadband or even, like, ample providers in where they live in rural places.
Or insurance, you know.
Insurance is a huge part.
Yeah, people are losing work. Insurance is tied to your work. And alternatives are not great. So,
So there's a lot of the heartening thing during my reporting that I found out was that a lot of regulation is being drawn up, or a lot of bills are being proposed to fight for price transparency for the patients, for the consumers, B, to support the adoption and rise of telehealth, and C, find funding to bring these to, like, more people. So it's hopeful, but it we need to, like, people need to be aware that there are issues so that we can address them.
Mm-hmm.
That went up, but the work doesn't stop there. I also am working on some stuff. That next week's going to be basically an entire crap show. So we are expecting, high-profile events to happen soon. So August 5th, once again, is some Samsung's Galaxy Unpacked. And, we usually do some prep work ahead of time for that. So that's coming up very soon. And, you know, August is expected to be a device-heavy month. So we'll see. There's really a lot I can't share right now, but I can tell you stuff is coming.
Expect some reviews. Expect some cool, long-awaited devices. How about that?
Yeah, there you go.
I'm working on a couple of things. I'm writing up an explainer about Thunderbolt 4, which I talked a bit about last week. We're going to be doing a video on that just because I think it is interesting. I've talked to Intel about it. It really does seem more like something that should be Thunderbolt 3.5, but there are enough new things to make it interesting and maybe make your next PC a little faster and a little more capable. So I find that really interesting. And I'm also going to be diving into a review of the XPS 17, Dell's, the first 17-inch XPS in a very long time. I think it's been 10 years since the last one. This thing, it's glorious. It has a major screen. Mm-hmm. What's up?
I was going to predict the score and, like, how you're going to evaluate this already. I predict you're going to love this, and I predict that the score is going to come in, like, high 80s, just below 90.
I mean,
on our review scale.
Probably, because it's a very nice machine. It has an amazing screen, and Dell's whole new design where there's barely any bezel. There's no screen bezel at the bottom. You know, the screen, like, kisses the keyboard area. It's just, like, beautiful.
Wow.
It's, like, right there. I think that design still works really well, but this laptop, it's 5.5 pounds or so, which is not bad for a 17-inch machine. Mm. So I'm pretty sure they're going to be, like, video editors and people who are into this. I do think, like, most people are better off with the 13 or even the 15-inch. Like, that's just a better balance of size and portability and power. But hey, this is out and it's pretty cool. So I gotta give credit to Dell for actually delivering a 17-inch laptop in a time when not many people are doing that.
Check out the LG Gram 17 too, while you're at it.
Let's move on to our picks for the week. One thing I'd recommend to everybody right now is the new Perry Mason reboot that's on HBO. Mm. I don't care about Perry Mason at all. I never watched that show growing up, even though I watched a lot of old classic TV. But this show, it's like a hard-boiled noir version of Perry Mason, starring Matthew Rhys from The Americans and a bunch of other movies. I love him as an actor, and I love noir. I love like smoky rooms and hard-boiled detectives and nefarious things happening among the rich people in Los Angeles. And the show has all that, and also looks amazing. So I'm really down with it. I think it can get really campy at times, but in a way that I think is really entertaining and fun. So shout out to that. I also want to say something about Grant Imahara, the Mythbusters co-host. Famous, like, I love this guy. Watching this guy on TV made me think I could do stuff around tech. And seeing somebody be so geeky really inspired me at a young age. He passed away suddenly this year at 49. It was a brain aneurysm, I believe. Jeez. Yeah, incredibly young. Just want to say, shout out to Grant Imahara for all the work he has done, for all the lives he's touched. He's a really remarkable person. And so, like, he was so unabashedly nerdy. And I always loved that about him and the rest of the Mythbusters crew. He will be missed. It's terribly sad.
I think that it brought about a renaissance of making science fun, something that people could relate to and say, oh, science isn't boring. It's explosions and car crashes. It's really a fun world to open up to.
Totally confirmed.
So I've got a mix of like somber and fun things to recommend. So let's start with the fun, I think. First of all, I've finally started watching Hannibal.
Oh yeah.
On Netflix, which Devendra insists he recommended to me, but okay. I don't know. If y'all can find an episode where he did,
probably not on the show, but in person, I've told you to watch this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But I really enjoy Hugh Dancy plays Will Graham, an FBI psychologist helping to track serial killers down. This is really in my wheelhouse. It's the behavioral analysis unit is something I follow religiously, at least on TV. And yeah, it's really great. It's a very weird show in terms of its depiction of, like, it's so weird.
I love it.
Very graphic.
This show aired on NBC, Sherlyn. This show aired on broadcast television.
That's crazy.
Ago. So Hannibal, like, really pushed the boundaries for, like, gore and what was acceptable. Yeah. And, like, it's a beautiful show. It is like horror turned into art because we know the Hannibal Lecter story, right? It's been retold a bunch of times, but I love everything about the show. So I'm glad you're watching it. I feel like my man Mads Mikkelsen, who I love, the villain from Casino Royale, he's been in plenty of movies recently too. He is such a tremendous actor and a perfect, perfect Hannibal.
He's incredible in this. He is incredible in this. And like, just, it kind of feels like a very macabre Bon Appetit video.
When you're
watching him in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that because I haven't watched all of the season yet. I just enjoy. Anyway, Hannibal is on
Hannibal's
Netflix.
Hannibal's on Netflix. It's great. And they may end up doing, I believe, a season four or some sort of movie. Like, they're talking about
it. It's already season four, I think. They may do season five.
Yeah, a season five.
Maybe.
Or, like, some sort of movie follow-up. They had teased. So, first of all, the guy who did Hannibal is Brian Fuller, one of my favorite TV writers. We're getting deep here. He had teased the idea of kind of towing into Silence of the Lambs through this series. Maybe even, like, hey, maybe we could get Ellen Page to be Clarice
Jodie
Starling.
Jodie Foster to be... Okay,
things are getting really interesting. But I'm hoping that works out.
I just saw the episode where Gillian Anderson guest stars. So that was great. Anyhow, Hannibal is great. If you want something actually even more gory and scary and weird, I watched Ju-on Origins as well Netflix.
How dare you bring up these two things on the same topic?
Come on. There are people who liked it. I liked it. I thought it was not exactly the same quality as the movies. The movies were really, really
only
really
the first
good.
Ju-on was any good. There were, but yeah, this is the whole thing.
Even the prequel, I liked the prequel. Stop it. Anyhow, it's not nowhere near as gory, but if you're a fan of the series, in the same way that if you're a fan of The Shining, the Dr. Sleep will make more sense to you. If you're a fan of Ju-on, the series, the movie series, I think you'll enjoy Origins because there are some little hints and tastes of what is actually like big Hallmark things in
my,
the movie that
my
sound,
thing about Ju-on, like that guy, that director, the croaking ghost, that director just made the same movie over and over and over again. Like all the sequels felt the same. So anyway.
I kind of liked that. It's fine. Anyhow, go do that if you're a horror fan. Now, I have I'm going to leave you with two surprising / educational things. So these are two YouTube channels I've recently been introduced to. And the first is the lighthearted one, which is called, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, Abba or Abba and Preach. They basically do very real conversations and reactions to videos online. So like there's some videos on YouTube by a channel called Jubilee where they play like strange games where you have to detect like who's the boy out of this group of girls, or like who's the one who's had plastic surgery out of this group of people, that sort of show. And Abba and Preach kind of react to that, and it's hilarious. It's a lot of fun. The other YouTube channel, and this is a slightly more somber one that I want everyone to kind of consider watching, is Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. And it's hosted by Emmanuel Acho. He's a football linebacker, I think for Texas. I'm not entirely sure. But he, you know, he started it a few weeks ago, I think, with just him talking to the camera, answering questions about what white people can do after all of the Black Lives Matter stuff was happening. Mm-hmm. And I think he targets it towards white people because they were asking him a lot of questions. His friends, his circle was asking him a lot of questions. Second episode has him talking to Matthew McConaughey, who actually saw the first episode and was like, and reached out and was like, I want to talk. And they have a real conversation where they just, you know, really go over some very important questions that people sometimes don't dare to ask. And Emmanuel Acho pitches it as a safe space for you to ask all of these questions because he thinks that the conversation is what's the most important. You have to start somewhere. You have to start asking questions first. So I think that there's an episode, I think later, like a more recent episode that deals with interracial dating, where for me, even I'm not a Black person, but I have a lot of similar experiences with interracial dating that I think that he addresses as well. So it's a very good watch. There's about 7 episodes so far. Check it out on YouTube if you want to learn about what's going on.
Well, that's it for this week, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Sherlyn online
on Twitter at Sherlyn Low. I can tweet now, even if I have a blue check.
Don't read Sherlyn's tweets, please. You can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com, at the /filmcast there. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Thanks for joining us, folks. We're out.